This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And free at last. Free at last. Edward Snowden, free at last, in the Russian Federation anyway. Big implications of that. We'll talk about it. Reports from the edge this hour, all hour long. Our profiles and testimony from caregivers this week has shown us scenes from the front lines of health care. It's not about policy or Obamacare or any of that. It's the simple care of one person for another. We're going to talk with two nurses who help family members gain the confidence to deliver life-sustaining care. They'll talk about what it's like to be coaches in a struggle on the edge of life. Also, the life-changing story of a mother and a son-in-law, how stroke gave a man a bond with his mother-in-law he never expected to have. And does the explosive growth of the internet represent a new opportunity to bring sexuality out in the open to battle predation and sexual ignorance, or is it a new opportunity to use the power of online media to shut down the pornography industry with new blocks and regulations? Two women on the front lines of this debate will have it out later this hour in a conversation that will test your tolerance for sexual candor. Let's just say that. But first, how one man may have cleared the deck regarding the relationship of the existing superpowers in a way not seen since the Cold War. Edward Snowden, by showing up in Hong Kong last month after revealing his classified secrets of U.S. domestic surveillance, may have changed China's relationship with the U.S. and Hong Kong's special relationship with the rest of the world. We'll speak with the outgoing U.S. ambassador to Hong Kong, Stephen Young, in just a moment. But the big story is Russia right now. You may recall that it took an invasion of Afghanistan back in 1980 to spoil this global pool party in Moscow.
President Carter won a major victory today in his bid to boycott the Moscow Olympic Games because of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
The United States Olympic Committee has decided not to send a team to the 1980 Summer Games in Moscow.
It's Don Miller, executive director of the U.S. Olympic Committee, announcing the boycott of the 1980 Summer Games, a boycott that more than 60 nations eventually joined. The Soviet Union and more than a dozen other nations retaliated 4 years later by boycotting the 1984 L.A. Olympics. Well, it took only one guy missing a flight at the Moscow airport to raise the prospect of an Olympic boycott in 2014.
I don't want to boycott the Olympics, but I want a policy that will get the Russians' attention.
That's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham on CNN explaining why he's open to the U.S. boycotting the 2014 Winter Games if Russia grants Edward Snowden political asylum. Russia's Vladimir Putin would have us believe that he's just trying to keep Snowden from doing harm to U.S.-Russian relations rather than exploiting him for any propaganda value. But today, Snowden got permission to leave Moscow airport as a possible prelude to eventual political asylum. Is Snowden the seed of a new Cold War, a political ace being played recklessly by Putin and company, or have the stakes in U.S.-Russian relations been raised by this now fully revealed prospect of high-technology surveillance and cyber warfare? Joining us with more on all this is Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Barnard College, Columbia University. Kimberly, welcome.
Thank you.
So Snowden being free in the Russian Federation, has Putin marched across a tripwire here on some level?
I don't think so yet. He had no choice under Russian law except to make a decision today, because today was 8 days after the application was filed. And what he has decided on is merely that his application for asylum will be considered. And so that gives Putin 3 months to actually make a real decision about what happens next. And so I think it's without question, it was impossible that Putin would decide at the end of this 8 days to send Snowden back home.
Carter administration said it was impossible not to boycott the 1980 Olympics after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Is now the Obama administration in a corner? They have to retaliate. They have to do something, cancel this summit later this year in Moscow?
I doubt it. I mean, what is really happening, you know, if you look at even what the Republicans are saying, Boehner said he wasn't interested in having the boycott of the Olympics. The athletes want to go to the Olympics. The American public wants the Americans to go to the Olympics. So I think that was more a shot across the bow than anything that's seriously going to happen. You know, the action that Obama could take is to not go to Moscow before the G20 meeting in St. Petersburg. But I think by having this be a 3-month process where Putin can just take time to think about what happens next with Snowden, it's essentially letting Obama off the hook, because Obama can say that he can wait to see what really happens in Russia.
So are they trying to dodge the Snowden thing, or is
yes.
Putin? They are, really. But to be clear, you raise the prospect that this summit will be canceled, that Obama will maybe skip it or do some sort of dodge to maybe not be seen glad-handing Vladimir Putin in the midst of all this?
Well, I think Obama is giving back to Putin exactly what Putin is giving Obama. Putin is giving Obama all kinds of uncertainty that may be humiliating for what Obama needs to do politically. And Obama is turning around and having leaks, saying maybe we won't go to the Moscow meeting before the St. Petersburg G20 summit. But they're playing the same game, and it's all diplomatic smoke and mirrors at this point.
But the underscore here is that there's suddenly a front, a fairly confrontational front between the U.S. and Russia regarding domestic surveillance, electronic surveillance, the idea that we're engaged in some sort of cyber confrontation here in the 21st century.
Well, the decline in relations between the U.S. and Russia has been going on for, you know, years. And so I think this is just one more bump in the relationship. And there are so many more important things that are happening, like negotiations over the Iranian nuclear program, negotiations over what might happen with Syria. And so I think that mostly this is more a political hot potato for both sides because of the domestic audience rather than something that actually has real meaning.
So here's the mystery for me. Here's the real head scratcher for me. I mean, during the Cold War, there was a real binding force. The mutual assured destruction, the whole nature of the narrative of the Cold War bound the Soviet Union and the United States together on some level. They had to talk. All of the issues sort of fit into fairly neat categories here. It's a little of this and a little of that in terms of the way Russia and the United States are relating to each other. That seems a little more unstable.
It is unstable, but at the same sense, nobody's talking about war breaking out. And so, you know, you look at things like what the Russians are doing in Syria, and they promise more weapons. But what happened with the weapons that were delivered a couple of weeks ago? The Israelis came in with a strike and destroyed them. And so you start thinking that maybe what Russia's interests are more commercial rather than strategic. It's not that they actually want Syria to be a strong state against the United States. It's that they want to get money for their defense companies that are trying to do exports to keep themselves going.
Is this a win for Putin then today?
It's a minor win for Putin, but he really didn't have a choice. He wasn't going to bow to U.S. pressure and let the United States extradite Snowden. And so he really didn't have a choice. And I think if you look at what's happening with all the things in Putin's life recently, it's all kinds of uncertainty. And I don't think his position is as firm as it used to be, especially what's been happening with domestic politics.
Well, we'll see if it's a win for Edward Snowden going forward. Kimberly Martin, the Ann Whitney Olin Professor of Political Science at Barnard College, Columbia University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
To China now. It took a queen and the British government of Tony Blair to officially hand over to China the colonial territory of Hong Kong back in 1997, part of the ceremony there, which was supposed to celebrate Hong Kong's special status within China and as something of a free zone, immune to the temptations of the communists in Beijing to meddle or take full control. But it may have taken only one Edward Snowden to unravel 16 years of Hong Kong's apparent autonomy.
The Snowden incident did concern us because we had hoped for better cooperation with them, and we believed China was a factor in them not being able to give us the cooperation on getting him extradited to the United States that we were seeking.
Outgoing U.S. Ambassador to Hong Kong and Macau, Stephen Young, says that the Snowden incident tested the special U.S. relationship with Hong Kong, and Hong Kong, he says, failed.
They did fail the test. That we believe that Snowden had broken the law in the United States and should be put up for extradition so he could face charges, and they let him go to Moscow. I've had a dialogue with top officials here about that, and they're somewhat defensive, calling it all worked by rule of law. We suspect that China was a part of this in saying, get the guy out of here, and that's what happened. But there's a little bit of, you know, fuzziness behind the mirror. The bottom line was that we had made a request under an existing extradition agreement, and Hong Kong claimed that we hadn't given him enough evidence and then called me up one Sunday afternoon to say he was on a plane to Moscow.
Well, Ambassador Young, I hate to ask you to speculate as much as I can't resist it, but I'm wondering if Snowden's allegations had been less serious, if they had involved less of a kind of broad swath of the national security establishment, if it might have been more likely that the Chinese government would have allowed Hong Kong to deal with this. The seriousness of Snowden's allegations and revelations and whistleblowing, whatever you want to call it, really evoked the whole U.S.-China relationship on a whole number of levels. And I'm wondering if that was the key.
Well, I'm going to be a little elliptical in my response. we had made some serious claims about Chinese cybersecurity problems, particularly recent messages that we'd seen suggesting that they were hacking into business systems and stealing IPR, which is a major issue for the government as well as the business community. So this was heaven sent for them to sort of say, oh, it's not us, and in fact, you guys. But I think he played to his audience, and it was convenient to them.
What do you think the implications are for Hong Kong? It seems to me on one level, China, by approaching Snowden the way they did, has tried to leave a lot of these questions unsettled, still up in the air, that maybe the test for another day is still out there. But I'm wondering if the U.S. sees that actually, no, there are doors closed now regarding the relationship between Hong Kong and the United States.
I wouldn't be that pessimistic, John. I'm finishing up 3.5 years here, and we have had very robust law enforcement cooperation as well as cooperation in a lot of other areas here in terms of the huge business community, 1,400 companies, 60,000 Americans. So there's a lot going on that is positive. This was a case that probably rose to that level that China couldn't lay off and decided that his not going back to the United States for justice was the right thing to do. But I guess the bottom line is that when China really wants something that has to do with Hong Kong, they probably have that trump card. The fact is we want to make it used as little as possible because, to us, a Hong Kong that is more open, more engaged with the outside world, and in this case now looking at more democratic institutions, is all playing to values that the United States really appreciates and allows us to have a relationship here that you couldn't have with another city in China.
Well, then on the way out, let's explore that just a little bit further. As you see Hong Kong departing from there, as you are, is Hong Kong an agent of reform within the People's Republic of China at this point, or are we more on a track where eventually there will be a time when Hong Kong is like any other city in China? It just has a consulate. There's no sort of special diplomatic relationship between Hong Kong and the rest of the world. Which is it?
Well, you know, let me be a little broader on that. It's a great question. I was the head of our special office in Taiwan for 3 years before I came here. And to me, you have in Hong Kong today and in Taiwan two ethnically, linguistically, and culturally Chinese entities that are much more open, and whether it's free press or rule of law or democratic institutions, which are fairly well established in Taiwan and emerging here, these are things that are just not present in China. And I think the fact that a lot of Chinese tourists are visiting Taiwan and Hong Kong and seeing this system, as well as watching television in southern China from Hong Kong, gives them an idea that Chinese people can do things differently.
Ambassador Stephen Young, American Consul General in Hong Kong and Macau, thanks so much.
Very nice talking with you. Thank you.
You've jumped into a debate we're about to have. Listener from KQED San Francisco writes, there should be no restriction on the Internet, nor any can exist. Time and again, users of the Internet have easily averted barriers and restrictions. But another listener from Cincinnati, Ohio, says, ban porn websites from the Internet. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8MYTAKE. Once again, sexual content online threatens to derail a politician. Former Congressman and Democratic New York mayoral candidate Anthony Weiner acknowledged that more images and text messages of a sexual nature have surfaced, including some texts to women sent after he resigned in scandal 2 years ago.
I've apologized to my wife, Huma, and I'm grateful that she has worked through these issues with me and that I've had her forgiveness.
It's political figures like these, some charged with lapses and others squeaky clean, who regularly advocate that there should be a way for regulating sexual content online. Perhaps it's a case of the foxes watching the hen house, but the debate over monitoring and regulating sexual content online, everything from hookups to porn, is a thorny matter of free speech, detecting and discouraging crimes of predation and violence, and it raises some issues of morality and culture. In the UK this week, British Prime Minister David Cameron has been seeming to try and guilt-trip the internet industry in the UK to sign on to a way of regulating pornography and all of the less than completely wholesome forms of entertainment on the internet.
We don't accept that our children can wander into a shop and buy alcohol aged 12, so why should we accept that they can wander around on the internet and get access to things that they shouldn't?
Cameron's solution is to get internet providers to voluntarily agree to block access to pornography unless users specifically opt in by removing filters from their internet content. So how does such a voluntary effort contribute to internet policing? Does it get in the way of free speech and maintaining what some consider a healthy openness about sex? It can be a difficult conversation to have, but we're going to have it. Sydney Gallup joins us, advertising agency legend and founder of Make Love Not Porn. Welcome, Sydney.
Thank you.
Gail Dines is also with us, professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College in Boston and founder of Stop Porn Culture. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, Gail, is this constructive in your view?
I think it's a good step in the right direction. It's not going to be, obviously, a panacea. It's not going to solve all the problems of mainstream violent internet porn. But I think if you say guilt-tripping, would you argue that you guilt-trip Walmart into having proper regulation practices for their workers? So this is not about free speech. It's about the corporate speech and really regulating corporations, as we do all the time.
Gail Dines, professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College in Boston, making David Cameron's point. Cindy Gallup, advertising agency legend, founder of Make Love Not Porn, you disagree?
I think David Cameron's taking the wrong approach. I think the answer to everything that worries all of us about the total freedom of access to hardcore porn online today for young people and children is not to shut down, clamp down, block, censor, repress. It's actually to open up. We've never been at this moment in time before with this extraordinary access to porn. We cannot afford to carry on operating around sex and porn in the way that we have been. We need to have an open, healthy conversation. We need to open up the business arena. People like me and my team, who are working to change the world of sex and porn for the better, are finding business and tech doing everything they possibly can to stop us. Because every piece of business infrastructure, any other venture can take for granted, we can't. The small print always says no adult content. I believe you can change the world through sex. The world of business is doing everything it can to stop me. Where's the sense in that?
Let's talk about one aspect of what Cameron was speaking about, and something that actually has precedent in the United States. Right now, law enforcement agencies in the U.S. at the federal level are permitted, or at least if we're to believe Edward Snowden, they're permitted to do a lot more than this, but they monitor searches of specific content that would imply child sex trafficking, child pornography, those sorts of things. Interpol is apparently involved in some of that. David Cameron wants to extend that to searches in the private sector in the UK. Do you support that sort of thing for the narrow content of child pornography and child trafficking?
I don't believe that that is going to solve the problem. You know, when you try and control anything by clamping down in every way you possibly can, you force something even further into the shadows and underground, and you make more bad things happen.
Gail Dines, do you believe that innovation and openness is an option here in preventing the downside of pornography?
Well, I think Cindy's doing a great job of giving the industry position, and that's where Cindy comes from, and so obviously that's who she's going to speak for. I mean, let's really look at what's going on here in reality. We know from studies across the country and across Europe that the average age of first viewing pornography is 11 years old. It's a business. And I think what Cindy said, you're going to change the world through sex. You're not, Cindy. The world is going to change through people organizing together for equality and justice. And pornography is an industry that is based on inequality, sexism, misogyny, racism, and the hatred of women.
Cindy Gallup.
I bring a relatively rare perspective to this whole area, which is a business perspective. And it's only rare because the people whose brilliant brains fill the pages of the Harvard Business Review have no interest in turning any of that brilliance on the adult industry, and they should. The explosive rise in extreme violent porn is not driven by evil, malignant, twisted, vicious forces within the porn industry. It is not driven by, oh my God, we've all become more depraved and corrupt as human beings. It's driven by a bunch of guys, scared s*** because they're not making any money, looking around and doing what guys scared s*** not making money in any industry do, which is playing it safe. Oh, they're making that must sell, we'll do that too. as in the washing powder industry, so in porn. And until you actually open up the ability for entrepreneurs and innovators to come in and innovate and disrupt in the world of sex and the world of pornography and change it for the better, as Silicon Valley and governments everywhere around the world are inviting in every other sector except this one, you will just continue to see more worse things happen.
Cindy, I guess I'm having a little trouble, and I don't necessarily want a picture here in literal terms, but seeing what this alternative to regulation is that's going to, in some sense, soften the pornography message that Gayle Dines is so concerned about.
Well, I guess I'd use our own example with Make Love Not Porn. Parents write to me all the time. A man wrote to me on Facebook a few months ago, a father, to say, my wife and I cannot thank you enough for what you're doing. We have a 10-year-old son, and we decided it was time to have the sex talk. And when I sat down with him, he said to me, Daddy, why do men wear masks when they're having sex? And this man wrote and said, we have parental controls on our iPad, and yet my son has managed to find his way to a site where men wear masks when they're having sex. You can't stop that happening. What you absolutely need to do to counter it is to encourage parents to realize that this addressing this whole issue starts in the home. And that's enormously important because, in my estimation, less than 5% of parents ever talk to their children about sex, and they need to. As a society, we need to encourage a more open, honest, healthy dialogue around sex in the real world, and we need to open up and encourage more people to innovate and disrupt around this whole area.
Cindy Gallup started the ad agency BBH, the founder of Make Love Not Porn. We also spoke with Gayle Dines, professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College in Boston. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
To Egypt now, where the front lines of civil unrest seem to be slipping away from the interim government. Mohamed Morsi, the former president, who many believe to have been basically kidnapped by the new regime, is out of sight. But Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is urging people to take to the streets of Cairo on Friday to support the interim government and to restore calm. He's denied accusations that he in any sense betrayed President Morsi. Joining us is Kristen Chick, Cairo correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome.
Thank you.
How credible is the Army Chief in both calling for this demonstration and claiming that he's free of charges of betrayal?
Well, I think his speech today is a very clear warning that should be taken very seriously. You know, he's asking people to go into the streets on Friday to give him a mandate to fight terrorism. And by that, we can understand that that he does not intend to compromise with the Muslim Brotherhood, and he wants the public to give him a blank check to crack down quite harshly on them.
Is he accusing the Muslim Brotherhood now, the last elected leadership in Egypt, of being terrorists?
I think he is. Yes, that's implicit in what he said. You know, we've seen this rhetoric since Mohamed Morsi was ousted for several weeks now. The opposition channels, the newspapers have been calling what the Muslim Brotherhood is doing terrorism. A presidential advisor said that to me the other day, accused them of inciting acts of terror. So, yes, I think that is what he's saying.
For most of their existence, the Muslim Brothers were insurgents, were secret opposition forces in Egypt. In a sense, they are more skilled at that sort of thing than they are in governing. And we certainly saw that with Mohamed Morsi. Is the army chief asking the country basically the question, wouldn't it be better to have the Muslim Brothers underground than the way we tried to do it with the democratic forces?
Yes, that is what he's asking. And I think he's going to find a public who is very willing to let the army do that. That since Mohamed Morsi was ousted, people have been very angry at the Brotherhood. They've been calling them terrorists. They've been quite willing to see the Brotherhood push back underground and not take part in the political process going forward. So I think Sisi realizes that he's got a public that is quite willing to let him do this, and he's capitalizing on that.
But how do you claim a mandate from people who show up into the streets? How's that going to work, and how's that going to stick?
Well, this is what Egyptian leaders have been doing for the past few years. You know, we saw the Muslim Brotherhood do this to pressure the first military government in 2011. We've been seeing this over and over again. It's sort of a numbers game. Instead of relying on the ballot box, people call their supporters into the street, and whoever has the biggest crowd wins. And it's not a recipe for stability, but clearly, you know, Sisi has decided to go this route.
And it's a 21st century version of voting with your feet, in a sense, something that has a long history in the Middle East, but resurrected here with mixed results in Egypt.
That's right. I mean, we saw this on June 30th. Sisi took his, the military overthrew Morsi after we had millions of people in the streets. And so I think Sisi's now saying, let's take this one step further.
Kristen Chick is Cairo correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Have you noticed? Interest rates are rising in an uneasy credit market, and it is a sobering issue for students seeking college tuition loans. The prospect of huge taxpayer liabilities has stalled a deal on federal student loan interest rates in Congress, but there may be a deal this week. Under the plan, interest rates would be tied to financial markets but capped at 8.25% for undergraduates and 9.5% for graduate students. The important deal got only a lukewarm review in a conference call from Secretary of Education Arne Duncan yesterday.
This is an important starting point, but by no means does this start to make college in a really substantial way much more affordable for American middle-class families, which I think our collective goal has to be.
With me is the Republican senator from Oklahoma, Tom Coburn, who is part of the bipartisan group of senators that supported the bill. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, John.
So there's a couple of things to think about here. There's the question of making it easier for students to go to college through the federal loan programs and the other loan programs, but there's also something of a bubble looming in the loan program for students and the overall indebtedness of college students and college involvement in that. Does this forestall a crisis on both fronts?
Well, maybe not on both fronts, but it certainly does make available. First of all, it equalizes undergraduate loans. So we've given the average middle income student going to college a pretty good size break on their interest. Number two is it gives them a fixed rate so that they're not at the mercy of what the market's rates are going to be. In other words, whatever they take it out as, that's what it is for the life of the loan, which is important when you're making a decision about spending that kind of money to go to school.
How much is the market driving this? We saw student loan rates doubling this year from 3.4 to 6.8%.
Yeah,
there's
that
a lot.
That had nothing to do with markets. That had everything to do with Congress's incompetency. And the real battle is, John, the country's going to borrow $1.6 trillion over the next 10 years to finance student loans. It's stupid, but we're going to do that. And what we were set up to do is to lose a significant amount of money on that as American taxpayers. And so what we've done with this bill is given people fixed rates, tied it to the market rate, and ultimately they'll have a cap on how high it can go.
But to attract a sufficient pool of money to cover the students that are going to meet the need, is the market incentive for that interest rate to rise that high enough for the banks and financial institutions to come in and keep the taxpayer from having these losses?
Yeah, well, nobody can predict exactly what that's doing. The original bill that we had agreement on didn't have a cap other than a consolidation cap. But still, the cap on unsubsidized or undergraduate loans is 8.25%, and on graduates is 9.5%, and on PLUS loans, which is consolidated or parent loans, is 10.5%. And this authorizes this for the next 10 years. So hopefully we're not going to lose a penny on it.
Is that the nature of the debate here? There's bipartisan support for investing in education, but taxpayer losses are unacceptable in this Congress?
I think that's where we stand. you know, as a fiscal conservative, I don't think this is a role for government. I think markets ought to determine it. And what we're seeing with the prices of tuition at universities, the more money is available, the faster they raise tuitions, not by giving more value, but because they can. And so one of the causes of the rising tuition to colleges have been the ease with which federal money can be utilized to spend money at colleges. So there's a lot of problems with the student loan program. It's not that we don't want people to go to school, but what has been the response of the universities in terms of the available money has been to raise rates. You know, the fastest rising thing in America the last 20 years hadn't been health care. It's been the cost of a college education.
Are you comfortable being a leader on this issue, or is this more of a foxhole for you?
Well, I'm comfortable trying to solve problems to where we don't cost the American taxpayer any money and we enable people to get an education. The federal government's involved in it, so what I want to do is make it the least costly to the taxpayer as I can.
Senator Tom Coburn, Republican from the great state of Oklahoma, talking about a bipartisan deal with a group of eight senators that will allow students to avoid higher interest rates on federal loans to college. Senator Coburn, thanks so much.
You're welcome, John.
And now a look back at the front lines of healthcare in America, the front lines of caring, that army of nearly 66 million caregivers in this country. That front line we've been looking at this week can be a lonely place.
I'm Donna from New Jersey. I am the sole caretaker of my son, who is autistic. At the same time, my husband lost his job and our health insurance in 2011. It makes for a very tense household, which makes my autistic son more anxious. Lots of people have lots of advice, but no one ever offers any real help.
We've heard all kinds of stories of families pulling together to care for a loved one, moms doing it alone, stories of the network of people, a real community that can form around the care of a loved one. We heard from Margaret Peggy Batten, whose husband, Brooke, is severely disabled after a bicycling accident.
It can be quite extraordinary. It's a community of people who care for him in a medical way, but they also care about him. I think it's not a distortion to say that he has come to love them, and they have come to love him. It's quite remarkable. It takes work to do this, and that's part of what makes caregiving work, the part that he does, not just the part that they do.
Think of all these home caregivers as coaches as well as healthcare providers. They are paid professionals, but in homes where someone is being cared for, they can become part of the family. Amelia Blake and Jennifer Luciano know all about the business and blessings of compassion. Jennifer Luciano is a certified home health aide, and Amelia Blake is a registered nurse. They both work with the Visiting Nurse Service of New York. Amelia says every day she sees the ways people can slip into a feeling of isolation, doing work that's never done, always unpaid, and rarely recognized by anyone.
I think it's very unrecognized. When we leave, we as the nurses and the aides, we go in and we're providing that care for that patient for 30 minutes or depending on the aide, if they're there for 6 to 10 hours a day for them. When they leave, the caregiver, again, takes over that role. And it can be very overwhelming for them because it's not a job that they're getting paid for.
Right.
You know, there's no recognition for it. There's no recognition for making sure that the patient's eating correctly. And a lot of the patients who are elderly and confused, demented, they're not even there to recognize to that caregiver that, hey, you're doing something that benefits me.
Jennifer Luciano, certified home health aide with the Visiting Nurse Service of New York. Most frustrating caregiving experience you've ever had where you felt like, man, I'm not helping here. I'm hurting or nothing's working.
I could probably name one incident where I went in and she confused my services as being a maid.
Mm.
And she had a family member there. She had her two daughters. Sit, do this, do that. Don't sit down yet. What are you doing? I'm like, hold on. Where's the plan of care? This is what indicates my job. This is what I'm supposed to do. Out of this, I'm not supposed to do anymore. And I had to draw a fine line.
How hard is it at the end of life when the care is constant and there's really just not a lot of time?
That's difficult. You don't ever want to see nobody suffer. No matter what they tell you during training, you go into someone's home. This is their home, their personal space. And you come in as a stranger, you come out as a family member. It always happens. It doesn't take years for that to happen. In a matter of weeks, you can be considered a granddaughter, a daughter figure, a son figure, because there's male in the profession as well. And it's difficult when you see someone during their last stages. You feel good because you did what you were supposed to do, but still, you still feel this yearning of wanting to do more, although you know there's nothing more you could do for that person.
Have you ever gotten too close, maybe so close that in those moments you really feel that sense of loss, like a member of the family?
Always. And, you know, like Jennifer says, we're part of their family, and it does. We can be in there for a week, you know, years in some cases, and we become a part of their family. So watching them go through that process is like watching your family member go through that process. I have a patient who's going to be 102 on Thursday. 102. When I met her, she was 99. And when I first met her, I walked in and she's, you know, with this wheelchair coming to the door. And I'm thinking, wow, you're here by yourself at 99? And, you know, she says, the day I can't take care of myself is the day I check myself into an assisted living facility. And I'm like, you're 99. When is that day going to be? Fast forward, it's going to be 3 years later. And she's just now checking herself into an assisted living facility. You know, so it's just amazing. These patients are amazing to me.
You hear these stories of people in New York and elsewhere where you become a part of the family and, you know, you end up in the will or something like that. You know, crazy stories like that. I want to do something for you. You know, you've been so important to me. You know, those are kind of funny stories. But they also say what the value of being a caregiver is. Can you say what the value of being a caregiver is based on your experience, Jennifer?
Patience, loyalty to that person. You go with your heart on your sleeve. And me personally, into every situation I go to, I just want to give everybody a hug. And I'm like, it's going to be okay. I'm here to help you. I'm here. And I will be your cane if you need me to. That's what it means to me. And them having that assurance that it's okay, Jennifer's here. I'm okay with Jennifer. I know nothing will be wrong because Jennifer's here.
We talk about those as values of caregivers, but those are the values we'd expect in just life generally, right?
Exactly.
Exactly. You know, the love and compassion that forms when we go in to take care of our patient, that's actually what you're teaching more of, how to be loving and compassionate as they're going through this hard time, whether it's, you know, learning about their disease or approaching their end of life. That love and compassion that everyone deserves, that's what being a caregiver means to me.
Jennifer and Amelia, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
It's been great having you here.
Thank you so much, John.
Amelia Blake is a registered nurse and Jennifer Luciano is a certified home health aide. They both work with the Visiting Nurse Service of New York. Coming up, a listener shares his story of being caregiver for his mother-in-law, Mary, and how it's changed his family forever.
As soon as she'd get off work, she'd go straight over there to the nursing home, and then I'd have to go back at midnight, say, it's time to go, you know, the kids are tired, they're already in bed, you know, you need your rest, we need to go to work, and she wouldn't do it, and I'll be darned. She wouldn't sleep, but then at 6 in the morning, she was right back there saying, you know, how's mom doing, you know.
This is The Takeaway. You know, we started this week with the hope, the mission, really, that caregivers would feel less alone in the world, that they would hear some stories on the air and want to reach out and say, hey, I'm here too, which is exactly what listener Frank Medina in San Antonio, Texas, did. He wanted to let us know about his experience caring for his mother-in-law, Mary, who had a stroke back in 2010.
Mary is one of those ladies that grew up in a different time period. She was the one that always had to be busy. She was always running around. She was always doing something. And so one day when my wife called, it's like, well, she's asleep. And that was kind of odd. Mary never sleeps, you know, throughout the afternoon. And she called again. And, you know, her dad said that she was still asleep. And she was like, well, something's wrong. Go over there and check out what's going on with Mary. So we went over there and Mary had had a stroke during the night. And because her father's of elderly age, he didn't know. He thought she was just tired. And that's what started everything. And so, of course, when, you know, we called the ambulance, took her to the hospital, you know, and they're like, what hospital? Well, you don't even know. You're like, you know, she needs care right now, you know. So we took her to the hospital downtown, and they gave us 30 days. And, of course, that tore my wife up, you know, 30 days, person had a stroke because of her age. And it's like, no, she's going to need a lot of care. And, you know, Mary pulled through. But I think it was because of my wife constantly being there. And before then, you don't know anything. There's a crash course, you know, in caregiving.
And you've got to learn it from nurses and professionals, and we've spoken to some of those folks this week, and you got to learn it on your own.
We have to learn it on our own. A lot of the nurses were very, you know, because they can tell if, you know, the first time that you're going through this, and so a lot of them were very, very helpful. You know, I said, you need to put her in a nursing home. This is the best we can do. She'll end the rest of her life in a nursing home. So, of course, here we go again, looking for nursing homes. There's no book. There is no book. We put her in the one that we thought was the best for San Antonio for her. That was close, so we could go see her. But, you know, we ended up spending more time there than we did at the house because, well, they have shift changes. And every time the shift changed, you know, of course, here we go again, starting over again. She's on this. She's allergic to this. You can't do that. Your food has to be soft. You just can't put the plate there. It has to be chopped up. You know, it was just constant. So my wife just came over from an exhausting day. My wife just sat there and said, you know what, we can do a better job than what they're doing at the nursing home. Nothing against the nursing home, but we can do a better job.
So let's talk about how this has changed your home. Obviously, your home isn't a nursing home, and the expectations are different. What's this been like, this experience been like for your kids and then for you and your wife?
So we had to find a different home, so we're renting this home right now, but we had to find one that's wheelchair accessible. So everywhere you go, Mary can move around in her wheelchair. She has, you know, she's paralyzed from one side, but that leg that works, she can get around. So that was like the first big hurdle. So it's not like she's a captive in her own room. We can move her to the kitchen. She can move to the living room. We move her to the dining room. We move her to the back. So that was like the biggest godsend that we had. It's just finding this place. As far as for my daughter, I mean, she's a trooper too. We would love for her to sit there and go with her friends on a Friday night and, you know, at 16, but she's there too, you know, when we're tired and she can tell and she goes, well, I'll put grandma to bed, and she will. She'll wheel her into the room, take her teeth out, wash her teeth, get her ready, dress her, and she can even lift her and put her to bed too, which I was real surprised with, you know, but that's not what I wish on her. I still want her to be a 16-year-old and, you know, enjoy going out and doing high school activities, you know, but she's a real trooper too. And as far as my wife, one thing that I really do wish is that she could get a good night's sleep.
Well, what's your larger message? Is there an experience here that has deepened your relationship with your wife's mother? Is there a sense of responsibility that you really want to convey to other people in America? Is there a sense of resentment, a sense of isolation?
No. You know, yes, you can get isolated, but you have to look at the moments, you know, that are just cherished for us. One day we woke up and Mary's just left. This is at 4 a.m. and she's laughing. We can't figure out. So here we are at 4 a.m. We're laughing because we don't know what she's laughing at. Those are those little moments that you'll remember, you know. But yes, you know, when people come in and say, oh, we're going on vacation and we're going to go over here, and, you know, they don't realize that, you know, our part is different because when we try to go out, we have to think, okay, is it wheelchair accessible? Mary can only do an hour in the car. Where can we go? Where can we take the kids? You know, it's tough on us, you know, and it can get sad, you know, but, you know, Mary's still alive, you know. Well, as long as Mary's still alive, you know, and we're giving her a good life, we're going to enjoy her.
We're talking with Frank Medina, who's the primary caregiver for his mother-in-law, he and his wife. She suffered a stroke in 2010. This is the way things were done in America, though, for most of history, that people did care for members of their extended family. People did take that responsibility. You weren't the unusual person in your neighborhood if there was a mother upstairs in a wheelchair, that sort of thing.
Yes, but, you know, it's part of our culture, too. I mean, we're from an extended family. We always had generations in the house, and we never thought anything about it. So when Mary had the stroke, that was like a no-brainer. You know, okay, this is it. This is what we did, and we all adapted to it. But we don't do it out of malice. You know, we don't do it out of spite. We do it because we care for this person. This is a great person. She's going to, when she does decide to pass or when she moves on, you know, we'll be happy. You know, the doctors keep telling us, you'll have to let go. You have to let go. You know, well, okay, we will let go when that time happens. But until then, we're enjoying Mary. She hasn't gone yet. You know, and that's where we get our strength from that. You know, we're happy when she's happy.
Do you feel like one of the 66 million or so caregivers in the United States, does that number surprise you?
Yes, it does, because you really don't realize how many of us are out there. You really don't, you know. And so it was when Mary had a stroke, I was real surprised that it was people that are like, oh, that would call us, you know, especially my wife, and say, oh, your mother had a stroke. How do you deal with this? You know, my mom's going is deteriorating. I don't know how to handle this. And now she has become like a support for her friends, you know, or even people that we don't even know. It's like, oh, you know, one of your friends told me that your mom had a stroke, and they're calling us to see how they can cope. You know, and so we just, you know, offer them the best advice that we can, especially if they're looking for, you know, nursing homes. You know, we're just, there's no book that we have to go by, you know.
Hey, Frank, you're the book.
We're the book.
You're the book. So before we go, how big is your army of caregiving there in the house? Obviously, it's you and your wife, and your daughter helps out.
Mm-hmm. We have two, and they're very wonderful. But even there, that was another problem. You know, you're going to entrust somebody. We have to go to work, you know, so you have to entrust somebody. And we found some delightful caregivers that, you know, we just think the world about. But, you know, things happen. They move. Their kids come into a situation. They have to move on. And then you're back up to square one again, you know.
How's Mary doing this week before we go?
Oh, Mary just woke up. She woke up in a good mood this morning. You know, we have to do our usual morning routine, you know, take her to do her, you know, business, you know, and get her up. And my wife's in a cheerful mood, and I'm in a cheerful mood, too. So it's a very good day.
Frank Medina cares for his mother-in-law in the San Antonio, Texas, one of the nearly 66 million caregivers in the United States, part of our week-long series. Frank, thanks so much.
You're more than welcome.
So Frank listens to The Takeaway on KSTX 89.1 in San Antonio. He's one, as we said, out of the 66 million caregivers in America out there. Here's another one.
This is Neil Lewis calling from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm a blind guy, and most people think that I would need a caregiver, but there are people with disabilities, including myself, who have been caregivers. I had the unfortunate responsibility of having to take care of my mother when she was diagnosed with multiple myeloma years ago. So being a blind caretaker seems kind of counter to what society thinks happens. But we, as people with disabilities, are not only just the people who receive the care, but also the caregivers as well.
How you doing out there, caregivers? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us on Facebook.com/The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.